I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The Saudi government is announcing a one-month amnesty for militants from that country. If they give themselves up in the next month, they will not face the death penalty, and if they did not commit acts that hurt others, they may not face prosecution at all. This, as Arabs from the region say, that the accent of the voice on the videotape of the beheading of South Korean Kim Sun-il seems to indicate that that terrorist is from the Arabian Peninsula.
And an audio tape found on an Islamic website today is also making news.
Allawi, afwan rais al-wuzara' al-muntakhab demokratiya, faqad a'dadna laka summan naqi'a wa sayfan qati'a.
That recording, also alleged to be from the group responsible for the beheading of Kim Sun-il, threatens the life of the interim prime minister of Iraq and vows to fight the Americans until Islamic rule is back on earth. The voice is supposedly of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the Jordanian-born terrorist whose hideout, American forces say, was the target of an airstrike earlier today in Fallujah. Well, joining us on the line from Baghdad is reporter Vivian Walt. Vivian, first of all, what do we know about this new audio tape?
Well, the Americans seem to believe that it is from Zarqawi, although, of course, they've not quite tested the voice yet, but they don't doubt it. I just came from a briefing with a senior military official who said that this is completely expected, that they're really struggling to kind of give top security protection for all these people, including, of course, Zarqawi, who's the prime minister, but that they actually expect that things could get pretty rough in the days immediately following the June 30th handover, and that, as he put it, that he expects Zarqawi and his associates to test the will of the new government by doing all it can to commit assassinations.
That's saying something, that it will get pretty rough. People might think it's been very rough with two beheadings, but what did U.S. military officials say to you today about these strikes in Fallujah, the second one today?
Well, they claim that they killed 20 foreign fighters and that they took out what they call a safe house of Zarqawi. They say that they've been gathering what they say is multiple confirmations of actionable intelligence, leading them essentially in a sort of inward spiral that appears to be focusing on Zarqawi. Now, I mean, we have to qualify the statement by the military. There's no way to confirm it. And several airstrikes of theirs recently have proved to be really way off the mark. Mm. Whether or not they did kill 20 foreign fighters, we do not know.
Vivian, before we let you go, we want to hear from you about what appears to be Iraq's first talk radio. You wrote about it today for the Boston Globe. What are Iraqis saying, briefly again, about the recent beheadings?
Well, you know, the fact that the beheadings, this is a, sort of an awful point about Iraq, but the fact that the beheadings have been of foreigners seems to kind of remove this a little bit from Iraqis themselves. They do not feel, it seems, the same revulsion as we do. They're very worried about the Zarqawi network because it appears to hit at Iraqi government infrastructure, oil pipelines, all of these things, which is obviously causing havoc in the country. The beheading of, you know, the American Nick Burr, the South Korean contractor, so that seems to be fairly distant from most Iraqis. They're very worried just about the day-to-day insecurity in this country.
And again, in just a few seconds we have, are they actively using this talk radio?
Oh, it's just incredible. I mean, it's really hit Baghdad in a big way. If you can imagine, this is a country that could barely, you know, talk openly for 35 years. Suddenly you have a commercial talk radio station that people can call in day and night to complain about anything, any level of government, and the lines are jammed. Mm. I mean, the managers estimate they take thousands of calls every day.
Mm. Well, Vivian Walt, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Vivian reports on Baghdad for Time Magazine and the Boston Globe.
Among the interrogation tactics once under consideration at Guantanamo Bay was the use of death threats against detainees and their families, also wrapping detainees in wet towels to make them think they'd suffocate. That information was revealed in hundreds of pages of internal memos released yesterday by the White House. Among the items in the 2-inch-thick stack of documents, a handwritten note from Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who works at a stand-up desk at the Pentagon. It asked, quote, I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day. Why is standing limited to 4 hours? Referring to a limit imposed by Geneva Conventions. Well, joining us on the line is John Hudson, Dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center in Concord, New Hampshire, who is also a former military lawyer. And Dean, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What do you find most interesting about these memos?
Oh, most interesting. Well, that's a good question. Most interesting. Certainly one of the most interesting things is that they have been released. You know that the administration has said now for quite a while that this information could not be released because it would give aid to the enemy. Now the pressure has built, and they've decided that the balance has shifted, apparently, so that for apparently political reasons, they've decided that it's a good thing to release them. The other thing that's interesting about it is that it is revealing of the internal discussion and debate that goes on, that went on in the administration on this issue, and it typically goes on in administrations on in important issues like this. In this case, dealing with torture, I think it's kind of a good news and a bad news thing. You know, the good news is that there was a debate going on, and that people vacillated back and forth on the definitions of torture and what was permitted. The bad news was that there was a debate going on, and people were vacillating back and forth on what was permitted, rather than simply saying we have to stick with the Geneva Conventions.
Mm. So under that, what techniques are allowable, and are those the ones that were used, for example, at Abu Ghraib?
I don't think that any reading of these would suggest that what we saw at Abu Ghraib with the leashes and the prisoners stacked naked and so forth would have been permissible. Getting people naked was probably permissible under what these memos seem to indicate. Scaring people with dogs and things like that was permissible. But they do reveal a back-and-forthness about how far we were going to let people go. In this kind of situation, when there's a lot of gray, you're just a whole lot better staying as close as you possibly can to the white area, I think. And that's how we ended up with Abu Ghraib, I think, is that we ventured off into the gray areas and then the dark gray areas, and pretty soon we were in the black areas. And I think that was a great tragedy.
And tell us more about the concerns that making this kind of information public allows terrorist groups to train their people against these techniques. You have to wonder which is better, disclosing or keeping them secret.
Well, of course, the rationales for each are completely different. The disclosure is quite clearly political. Keeping them secret was a good idea in terms of not allowing the enemy to say they may threaten to kill your families, but they don't mean it, that sort of thing.
Hmm. Well, then would you say that this is mostly about politics or something else?
Sure, I think that the releasing the information is about politics or perhaps charitably trying to restore the good name of the United States, but the timing is such that it has a political aroma to it.
Hmm. John, thank you very much.
That's quite all right. Thank you, Gail.
John Hudson is dean of the Franklin Pierce Law Center in Concord, New Hampshire, and a former military lawyer.
A team of American negotiators is offering new incentives to North Korea in exchange for what's being called a Libya-like dismantling of North Korea's nuclear program. The proposals are being presented at a series of talks in Beijing this week. Also at the table, China, Russia, Japan, and South Korea. The U.S. is offering to allow monthly deliveries of heavy fuel oil from the other participating countries, to lift sanctions, and to promise not to invade or destabilize North Korea. Andrew Ward is covering the meetings for the Financial Times of London. He joins us from Seoul in South Korea. Andrew, what's the mood at today's meeting?
At the outset of these talks, the mood was actually quite pessimistic. All the parties were saying that that our expectations should not be too high. But today there was this surprise, this report in the New York Times that the U.S. had offered a new initiative, a series of incentives for North Korea to disarm. If this is true, then this would represent a new direction for the Bush administration, which had previously been very firm in ruling out any incentives or rewards for North Korea until it had completely dismantled its nuclear program. Now, the reports seem to be true because James Kelly, the chief U.S. delegate, said in his opening address to the talk today that he was indeed ready to make a new proposal, a new offer to the North Koreans. And as these talks unfold now for the next 4 days, we will wait to find out the full details.
Well, are these going to be enough incentives for the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-il, who's said or indicated that he'd prefer to wait until after the elections to delay and maybe get a shot at talking to a Democrat who has, the Democrats have said they'll talk one-on-one?
Yeah, I think the consensus among analysts is that North Korea is very unlikely to strike a deal before the election for the reason that you explained. The Democrats, rightly or wrongly, are seen as maybe being a touch softer on North Korea. Kim Jong-il maybe thinks that he would get a better deal from a Kerry administration. So I think it probably doesn't make sense for Kim Jong-il to give up all these cards before the election. However, he will be under severe pressure from the Chinese, North Korea's biggest ally and aid donor, to make concessions. China is very anxious for these talks, which it has led, to make progress. So North Korea may have to show some sort of concession, make some sort of concession to keep the Chinese happy.
And what about internal pressure, the problems within North Korea? The country's been under these severe sanctions for decades.
Well, that's right. North Korea would very much like a deal that gives it access to energy aid. The country is electricity starved. People who go to Pyongyang talk of regular power blackouts and so on. So it would very much welcome the sort of deal that we're reading about today. However, the conditions are very tight. The U.S. is demanding, apparently, that North Korea would have to follow a very strict timetable, as did Libya, and actually remove plutonium and other nuclear materials from the country according to a very strict schedule. So I think that the prospects for a deal are still very much in the balance.
But again, that kind of negotiation did work with Libya. You say it's in the balance, but a sense that there's more of a chance that a deal might be struck either in these talks or soon.
I think people are surprised that there seems to be more momentum to this week's talks than had been previously expected. But we have to wait and see what North Korea says. The North Korean delegates at these talks don't have the authority to strike a deal. Only Kim Jong-il, the dictator, can say yes to a deal. So I think that the North Koreans will take back the U.S. proposal, and we will only really hear a response in days or weeks to come and after the close of these talks.
Andrew Ward, thanks so much.
Okay, it's a pleasure.
Andrew Ward covering the Beijing talks for the Financial Times. He spoke to us from Seoul.
Just ahead, Washington Post reporter Pamela Constable on covering death and trying to live a life during war.
And later, Attorney General John Ashcroft is sued for declaring classified information already in the public record.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Washington Post reporter Pamela Constable covered some of the biggest stories of the last few years: the fall of the Taliban, the war in Iraq, continuing strife in Kashmir. In a new memoir, Fragments of Grace, she takes a more personal view of her professional life as South Asia bureau chief for The Washington Post. Recently, she was in our studios to talk about the book, and I asked how she had been able to find those fragments amid the complex tapestry of the Persian Gulf.
One of the reasons I wanted to write the book was because so much of the news I was covering, so many of the events I was witnessing, were so painful. So many deaths were taking place all around me on my watch. I found myself sort of clinging to those small moments, those small gestures, those little touches of humanity that seemed to make it worthwhile. And I felt that it was important to try to emphasize that and to look for what was redeeming in situations and places where it was hard to find that.
Your observations of women in those worlds are particularly striking, I think, and especially in contrast to the freedom of your own life. At one point, you went out and bought and wore a burqa.
It's very strange because, going into Afghanistan we'd all heard from various groups, human rights groups, women's groups, that, you know, Afghan women were suffering and they had to wear this horrible garment that covered their bodies, and wasn't it a terrible thing? Well, when I got to Afghanistan, I realized very quickly that wearing the burqa, or the full head and body veil, was an Afghan tradition that went back centuries, and that, you know, a large percentage of Afghan women wore them anyway, Taliban or no Taliban. And one of the funny things about the experience was that, of course, as soon as I put it on, I felt terribly awkward and strange, and I thought, oh, everyone's looking at me. And then I realized a minute later, well, of course, now I'm invisible. Nobody knows who I am, and it doesn't matter what I look like. So it's a kind of a protection, it's a kind of an insulation from the world, not only an oppressive garment.
You also make the point in the book about how there is no pity amid extreme poverty, and that that's something that you also struggled with in yourself.
I think we in the West tend to almost romanticize the plight of people in other places that are struggling and suffering. It's terribly disillusioning to find that in so many countries, people who are struggling and suffering, you know, turn on each other. And that's a hard lesson to learn. It's hard to learn that lesson and still care and still want to be there and maintain your compassion and try to expose the wrongs that are done.
One of the ways that you found to cope with your surroundings and a life that can sometimes be lonely as a foreign correspondent is by adopting various pets.
If you'll permit me, I'll just tell you that in the past 72 hours, I brought with me from Kabul a wonderful, wonderful street dog named Dusty, and a wonderful, wonderful three-legged street cat named Mr. Stumpy. And Mr. Stumpy is now in a farm in Vermont. And Dusty is now sitting on the couch with some friends in Washington. And they said, the dog has reached détente with our cat, and they're now sleeping next to each other on the couch. I consider this a great personal triumph, which matters a great deal more than headlines.
Well, and some of the other ways in which you were able to make connections with people and to make a difference in your reporting. I'm reminded of a woman you met named Zahida Perveen. She was brutally disfigured in an honor attack. Tell us her story.
She was an illiterate village woman with several children, and her husband was a barber, and he suspected her of flirting with, I think, his brother or his brother-in-law or something like that. And so one day he came home, and he took his razor and chopped off her face. And at the time, she was pregnant with, I think, her third child. What was actually unusual about the crime was that he was actually arrested and put on trial. Often in these cases, nothing happens to the man. That crime was particularly grotesque and therefore unique, but unfortunately not unique in the frequency of the occurrence, not only among the very poor. I mean, it's something that happens in many levels of societies where you have sort of absolute dominance by men. You have a tribal culture in many places that permits this kind of thing to go on, and you have a religion that or religions that really put women in a place of almost total powerlessness.
I wonder if you would read a segment from the book where you have to identify a colleague who has been murdered on the job, 500 yards ahead of you. It's on page 204.
I steeled myself to look into each box. The third face was Aziz, but it was mottled and dark, like a bruised stone. I hardly recognized the blue-eyed, joking cameraman I knew. In those few horrible seconds, I realized I was staring at a death that could easily have been my own. I imagined my face in the coffin, my life extinguished without warning, my memories and dreams erased, my goodbyes never said.
Well, certainly not surprising then that toward the end of the book, you're really very reflective about the importance of family and also to the importance of home.
Yes, that's true. I've spent many years traveling for the Post, but it wasn't until I spent these 4 or 5 years traveling so far away that it was very difficult not only to get home, but even to call home. I really found myself thinking a lot about how I had given up so much. I had missed so many weddings and funerals, so many important occasions. And even though I was having extraordinary experiences and working hard to bring home to readers what was happening around the world, I began to feel a bit hollow inside. I began to feel this longing to just get back to my roots.
And have you decided yet whether it was worth it?
I think it was absolutely worth it. I think it would have been very difficult to have children and do the job I've done, which is the one major question that I think women particularly have to ask if they're people who travel for a living and are often in difficult places. But I don't regret anything. I think I have lived the most amazingly privileged life I could imagine. And that includes being in places without water or electricity or food to eat. It is and has been an enormous privilege.
Well, thank you. And thank you for helping us see the world through your eyes.
You're very welcome.
Washington Post reporter Pamela Constable's new book is Fragments of Grace, My Search for Meaning in the Strife of South Asia. To hear an extended version of the interview or for more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a piece of scholarship from 20 years ago is being misused by neoconservatives. That's according to the daughters of the author of The Arab Mind. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Attorney General John Ashcroft was sued this morning by the Project on Government Oversight for gagging members of Congress and their staffs who spoke with an FBI whistleblower 2 years ago. Last month, the Justice Department took the unusual step of retroactively classifying documents and congressional testimony going back to 2002, even though the information is currently available on websites, in newspaper archives, and in publicly available legal documents. The whistleblower is Sibel Edmonds, and she joins us on the line now from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome, Sibel.
Thank you.
Well, let's go back. You started working as a translator for the FBI after the 9/11 attacks, and you became concerned that there were some problems within the office that would hamper the U.S.'s ability to track terrorists. What were some of those problems that you complained about, got fired for, and then had to speak to Congress about?
Most of my job entailed working on translations and documents. I came across documents that were intentionally blocked from being translated and that were mistranslated, and also certain investigations that were being blocked for various reasons.
Now, for example, you appeared on CBS's 60 Minutes a while back and said you were concerned, among other things, that there was one colleague in the office who you felt was purposely mistranslating documents to protect a Turkish official who was being wiretapped by the FBI and who she had a personal relationship with. What was that about?
This individual, before joining the Bureau as a translator, used to work for certain semi-legit organization that was and is a top target of FBI investigations.
And they tried to recruit you as well?
Correct. And this person and her husband, they had ongoing relationships with at least two individuals who were top targets of investigations of the Bureau. And again, these were confirmed by the Bureau itself during their unclassified meetings with Senator Grassley and Senator Leahy's staff member.
And part of the information you've said that this person conveniently left out of her translations was the fact that this officer had spies working for him inside the U.S. State Department and at the Pentagon. So what was the FBI's reaction when you told him about this?
Well, their reaction was this was going to be a can of worms, and they asked me not to report this further up. And in return, they wanted to hire me as a full-time translator. And after I reported this to higher level management in the FBI and went to the Senate, they terminated me based on, this is what they cited, purely for the government's convenience.
So essentially, they didn't want to hear about it.
Correct.
One of the other problems that you've spoken about publicly is that you were told to do your work, but don't do it quickly, to the point that some of it was even lost in your computer?
Correct. Actually, during the first 2 months, this is September and October 2001, they being the Bureau, getting ready to propose their budget for next year, and they were going to take it to the Congress. And in order to do that, they wanted to pile up these translations so they could show that there was this huge backlog and they, in fact, needed increased budget or the increase in the number of translators.
Mm. So bottom line, it's shoot the messenger and also gag him, and you're the messenger.
Correct. And not only that, this is their attempt to cover up the investigations to 9/11, because this ends up affecting negatively the ongoing investigations by 9/11 Commission and also the investigation by the Senate, and it still is not being made public.
Sibel, thank you.
Thank you.
Sibel Edmonds is a former FBI translator. She joined us from Alexandria, Virginia.
In the past month, several reporters have refused to answer subpoenas to testify in the ongoing investigation into who leaked the name of an undercover CIA agent. But in a twist, Washington Post reporter Glenn Kessler did agree to testify before the grand jury because Louis Libby, chief of staff to Vice President Dick Cheney, freed him of any confidentiality obligations. Libby is thought by many, including former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, to be the source of the leak, which outed Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame. It's thought Wilson and his wife were targeted because of his criticism of the White House claim of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Washington Post reporter Kessler issued a statement saying that in his meetings with Libby, Plame's name did not come up. But meanwhile, other reporters are fighting their subpoenas. What is their obligation? Joining us on the line is Ali Colon, ethics group leader at the Poynter Institute. And Ali, you've written about this story. Journalists always fight revealing their sources. What's different about this case?
I think there are a number of complications with this case that make it difficult to deal with. The first one is having, you know, given that agreement of confidentiality in the first place. The other one is using the name of someone in such a sensitive position without considering the consequences that could flow from that. And the fact that at core, you know, when a journalist gives his or her word about what they will do, what happens when they're asked to violate that promise.
Could the story have also been about a White House operative, allegedly, willing to reveal a CIA agent's name?
Absolutely. I think it's interesting that the frame of the story, for the most part, has been on the journalist and not on the people in the government who know the name, who know who was involved. In my view, I can't imagine that the president or the vice president or anyone in some position of power in the White House could not go to their office people and say, who did it? And if the people were honest and loyal to them, say, I did it.
But I'm saying, isn't that the journalist's responsibility as well? In other words, in the heat of the moment, should a journalist have seen that that was equally a story?
Oh, that fact of that story?
Yeah.
I think it is another story as well. And I've seen some stories, but not as much written about that. And I'm not sure why that's the case. But in fact, that's true. There's part of that is the story as well.
And what does this mean in the larger sense of sources and leaks? If it is discovered who in the White House leaked this CIA agent's identity, what does that do to press White House relations?
Well, I think that what's most important is the relations between the press and the public, and that's first and foremost. And if people can trust the press, first of all, to make intelligent decisions about who they grant anonymity to and for what reasons, and that they can trust the press to keep the promises it makes. And the relationship between the White House and the press, frankly, is less important to me than the relationship between the press and the public.
Tim Russert of NBC and a journalist from Time magazine received federal subpoenas. Their news organizations say they're going to fight the subpoenas, saying they're not the recipients of the leaks. They were reporting what was already out there. Washington Post columnist Robert Novak was the first reporter to put Valerie Plame's name in print. Should he be forced to say who his, your opinion, should he be forced to say who his source was?
I think he can certainly be asked. I think it's up to the individual who made the promise to decide whether the promises they make are promises they keep, and what the value is and the importance of betraying or violating a confidence that you have promised.
Ali Colon, thank you.
Welcome.
Ali Colon is the ethics group leader at the Poynter Institute in St. Petersburg, Florida.
Still to come, the cult of Craigslist. You're listening to Here and Now.
The Federal Trade Commission announced today that it will not challenge the pending merger between tobacco giants R.J. Reynolds and Brown & Williamson, saying the deal does not threaten U.S. cigarette competition. Meanwhile, cigarette vendors in New York State will be obligated to sell only fire-safe cigarettes starting Monday, based on a law passed in 2000. A similar bill is before the U.S. Congress. Congressman Adam Schiff of California has supported similar legislation in his state. He joins us on the line now. Congressman, I understand these cigarettes have extra paper on them so that they won't burn down after a certain amount of time?
Well, they're less likely to ignite the surrounding surface if someone falls asleep smoking a cigarette and the cigarette remains on the couch or on the mattress. It's not fireproof by any means, but it has less of a propensity to ignite a fire. We lose hundreds and thousands of people, hundreds each year, thousands over a period of years, from fire deaths from cigarettes that are left unattended. Most people have focused, and rightly so, on the cancer-causing impacts and the death to a great many that result from cigarette smoking, but are less aware of the fact that a great many fires begin with cigarettes also. And New York's law and the law that we attempted to pass in California establish a stronger fire safety standard so that they have that.
What happened in California? Why didn't your law pass?
Well, we met the very strong opposition of the tobacco lobby, as you can imagine, and it was really quite fascinating because the tobacco companies that came to the committee to oppose the bill testified that, in fact, it was technologically infeasible to produce a cigarette with a lower propensity to ignite fires. But there was one very glaring absence from the committee room, and that was Philip Morris, because, in fact, while the very hearing was going on, Philip Morris was test marketing a cigarette, its Merit brand now, that has a lower propensity to ignite fires. And so they didn't want Philip Morris at the table to contradict the other tobacco companies who are testifying against the bill.
Yeah.
But the long and the short of it is the tobacco industry is enormously powerful. They were able to kill the bill in California. They were not able to kill the bill in New York. New York is now leading the nation, but they have stymied any progress really on similar legislation in Congress for a great many years.
Well, we understand that the tobacco companies are saying this is going to be great cost to them because they have to use extra paper. In fact, during their campaign against legislation, they actually started funding fire safety programs in order to, you know, in exchange those programs, ironically, then fought against the legislation. But what would you say to smokers who have told us that because they have to keep puffing on this cigarette to keep it going instead of just being able to hold it, let's say, in their hand, it's actually going to make smokers smoke more?
You know, I really don't buy it. I think there are a lot of reasons why people smoke and why it's so difficult to give up the habit, including the addictive capabilities of nicotine. But I think it has very little to do with the amount of paper in the cigarette or its propensity to ignite a fire. It's true it will add a few pennies to the cost of a pack of cigarettes, but that's a small price to pay when you consider the hundreds of lives of innocent people that are lost, not because they're smoking, but because someone else was careless when they were smoking.
Well, Congressman
Schiff.
Firefighters
who lost and families in the same apartment building that's burned down when someone falls asleep smoking.
Well, Congressman Schiff, thank you for your time, and I assume you're going to go back to the boards in California. Thank you.
You bet.
Congressman Adam Schiff of California, talking about fire-safe cigarette legislation.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Craig Newmark describes himself as a nerd, someone who can feel a little awkward at social gatherings, who remembers the pocket protector and the taped-together glasses he wore as a youngster, and who's found human interaction something of a challenge. In 1995, he set up a website to communicate with his friends, with listings of art and technology parties and other cultural events in San Francisco. 9 years later, Craigslist.org is one of the hippest, most popular websites anywhere, with an average of 450 clicks a second. At Craigslist, you can find a pet, get a job, buy a home, find true love, or at least get a date. Craig Newmark joins us on the line from San Francisco. Craig, welcome.
Hey, I'm glad to be here.
What did you imagine Craigslist would be when you first started working on it almost 10 years ago?
Basically, I was just helping some friends, and by doing so, helping myself as well. I just responded to what people in the community wanted, and basically it's grown into the site it is now.
Well, as it is, not a lot of flashing graphics, no pop-ups, no porno. How do you account for its great success?
We provide a service which is pretty useful and pretty effective. The site has a personality, which is the aggregate of the people who use it. And somehow we've built a culture of trust where people expect everyone else to be trustworthy, and we find that's the case. For the most part, we have very few predators on the site because of the culture of trust.
Manhattan, San Francisco, what are some of the other cities that you service?
Well, our top ones also include L.A. and Washington. But right now we have 45 cities, and people keep asking for more.
And you have a staff of about 14 people. How do you pay for them? Where do you get your money?
Well, basically we charge for job postings in the San Francisco Bay Area.
What are some of the more unusual listings that you have encountered over the years?
My personal favorite goes back several years, where someone put up an ad where they were trying to hire someone to take the CPA ethics test for them.
And what about the gentleman who wanted to find a kidney?
Well, that one was real, and the guy wound up with a kidney.
You have been quoted as saying that you feel this is just the beginning of the Internet's role in creating community. How so? Because many people would say, well, we're there. We've been doing this for a while.
Yeah. The Internet, for some years, has been used to connect people, to create a genuine sense of community. But it's just starting. People are finding new ways of connecting, and more people are getting online. So I think that's just the beginning of things. No matter what form people connecting will take, it's happening, it's going to happen in a big way, and I'm just trying to help in a little way.
Craig, thank you.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate it.
Craig Newmark is the founder of Craigslist.org. He joined us from San Francisco.
Well, searching for stuff on the Internet has become second nature for many of us. Search engines like Google make it easy to fact-find, shop, or cyber-chat. But how has the web changed the way we see the world and ourselves? In Boston, a group of young video artists from the School of the Museum of Fine Arts has been wrestling with that question, and now their cutting-edge works are on display in the curiously titled exhibit, Googling the Real. Here and Now producer Andrea Shea went to the Judy Rotenberg Gallery to check out their art and visit with professor and curator Mary Ellen Strom.
The title Googling the Real came out of many brainstorm sessions. We were looking at how we've moved out of a text-based culture into a visual-based culture. So much of the images in the installations, and we're calling them digital installations, are called from either the web, from e-commerce, from television. And we were attempting to understand how people were putting these images together and taking them apart to really give us a different idea of where we are right now in the 21st century.
I think it's appropriate that this show is happening in 2004. The web has been with us for 10 years now, and it has completely redefined our identities and reconstructed who we are. So in a way, it's a 10-year assessment of how this has changed, how we approach finding information, how we approach consumerism, how we approach communicating with each other. We're working in a space that is kind of a beautiful 18th century building on Newbury Street, and we're trying to address both the context of the site as well as the architecture. There's one installation that is in a window above a doorway, and this is a surveillance image, and there are eyes above the door, kind of looking at the spectator as you walk through the gallery space, perhaps looking at what you're looking at. There is another installation that is located in the bay windows. This is a triptych, and it's divided into three different panels, and it's called 15 Reasons to Go to War. And this three-channel video installation are all images that have been downloaded from the web and recontextualized into a narrative.
I'm Cliff Evans.
I'm David Matorin.
I'm John Raposo.
And we collaborated on the piece 15 Reasons to Go to War. Basically, it's an accumulation of still images created into a moving collage. To sort of describe the current cultural landscape through the lens of the internet. We basically use Google using key search words such as, you know, typing in something like interstate system and coming up with not only a bunch of freeway spaghetti bowls, but also people holding their pet ferrets and doing searches for things like freedom and coming up with, you know, people's personal websites that are specifically devoted to the parties that they throw and the wet t-shirt contests that they hold.
So there's a sort of buried poetry going on of the language of the internet.
And what's important about the piece is that we've followed a form similar to that of mass media or advertising in creating a huge spectacle of this accumulation of images. To create something very similar to what people are inundated with every day.
An example would be the images of models we have wearing Gap t-shirts, also holding assault rifles. I mean, these two both spectacular things, like, put together, sort of speaks about where they both come from.
Or if you can think right now, an image that we're watching right now is a spaceship constructed with numerous different people downloaded from the Department of Defense site. But in the background is Lance Bass from Boy Band wearing his spacesuit as he was preparing to go into outer space. In this scene, we've taken people from a Jimmy Buffett concert and juxtaposed them into a landscape similar to Afghanistan, where helicopters are still flying over, but all these people still have all their RVs and are very happy and partying and drinking.
The piece is epic, and it has sort of a lot of history, and will be reminiscent of Apocalypse Now and other epic films like that, but they don't have the same sense of narrative or the same reliance on narrative that other epics use.
I think all of these installations try and make us understand how much image pollution there is in the world and how literate we have had to become about reading images and how we have, come as a culture to understand these images, to shut them out, to pull them in, to reassess them, to be skeptical of them, to love them, to hate them, to understand how to survive within this bombardment.
Mary Ellen Strom is a professor at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. She's also curator of the video installation, Googling the Real. Here and Now producer Andrea Shea spoke with her and three members of the video art collaborative Terra Farmer at the Judy Rotenberg Gallery in Boston.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio
and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.